Hello everyone, welcome to The Lisa Burke Show. This week I'm delighted to introduce you to somebody called Steve Killalea, who is the founder of the Institute of Economics and Peace, the IEP, whom I was recently lucky enough to meet in Luxembourg when he was giving a keynote speech at the 12th Luxembourg Peace Prize. This took place on the 14th of June at Mudam in Kirchberg. And of course, that celebrates also the anniversary of the signing of the Schengen Treaty, which gathers global peace activists. A little bit more about Steve. He himself was Luxembourg's first Outstanding Technology Prize for Peace awardee in 2016. Now, the GPI is the most comprehensive data-driven analysis on peace, its economic value, trends, and how to develop peaceful societies, covering 99.7% of the world's population using 23 qualitative and quantitative indicators from highly respected sources. And a bit more again about Steve. He is himself an Australian entrepreneur who moved into philanthropy, created the software company IOR in 1988. It was listed on the Australian Stock Exchange in 2000. He also has a venture capital fund. And philanthropy has been riven through you. You set up the Charitable Foundation in 2000, launched the Global Peace Index in 2007, and set up the Institute for Economics and Peace in 2013. So Steve, I'm so happy to have you and welcome you onto my show, and thank you for taking time out of your family holiday.
Great. Oh, look, it's excellent to be here, Lisa, and it's good to talk to you.
Well, we'll get right into it because I don't want to take time from your family holiday, but just thinking about your career path, you had an incredibly successful entrepreneurship creation, made money out of this, and then decided to use that money for the good of the world. How easy is it for a wealthy person to set up philanthropic endeavours?
Well, I think for a wealthy person, it's much easier than without money, because you've always got your own money you can bring behind it. So we, out of the family now, we've created three different philanthropic entities. So the first one was a private family foundation to work on developmental aid. It's aimed at working with the most vulnerable people in the world, which you could describe as the poorest of the poor. And so that's been really quite successful. To date, we've done 280 projects, direct beneficiaries, about 3.7 million people. The second one was set up by my wife. That's to work with kids suffering from trauma using a form of therapy called play therapy, and that's been really quite successful. They've had tens of thousands of kids they've been through there suffering from all sorts of ranges of issues. Sometimes it's the death of a sibling, death of a parent, can be sometimes sexual abuse, and a whole range of other traumatic issues as well. And the final one, which was set up, the third, is called the Institute for Economics and Peace, which we're about to talk to here. Mm-hmm. So what it might do is just quickly, just like 1 minute, describe why that came about. So working with the poorest of the poor, when I set up the Family Foundation, I didn't realise that a lot of them lived in conflict zones or near post-war zones. And I was once in northeast Kivu in the Congo and started to think, what are the most peaceful nations in the world? Searched the internet and couldn't find anything. And that's how the Global Peace Index was born.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for describing that. And of course, it would have been my first question to tell us a little bit about that. It's an incredible point that you really discovered, because it's almost so obvious. It must have come as a shock that this research didn't exist.
Exactly. So what I think the learning from it was, what I realised, if a simple businessman such as myself, I mean, walking through Africa and think, what are the most peaceful nations in the world and hasn't been done, then how much do we know about peace? If you can't measure something, can you truly understand it? If you can't measure it, how do you know whether your actions are helping you or hindering you in achieving your goals? You simply don't. And so that started me on the journey to peace. And the Global Peace Index was the first thing which we did. We moved on and started to study terrorism, and then start to use a lot of mathematical modelling, statistical analysis to understand the things which are most closely associated with highly peaceful societies.
And speaking of highly peaceful societies, I have some notes that I made from your keynote speech. In Luxembourg, the most peaceful countries in the world include Iceland, Ireland, Austria, New Zealand. And then at the bottom of the list, I suppose it's no surprise really, but just to name some of them, Israel, Mali, Syria, Russia, Congo, Ukraine, Afghanistan, South Sudan. Was there anything in the top and the bottom of those lists that surprised you in this work?
Well, not so much. I think, well, one of the things which we do see is then when we're looking at the most peaceful nations, and we're looking at the least peaceful nations, there's a widening gap between them. This is what we call the global inequality of peace. So the most peaceful nations getting slightly more peaceful, whereas the least peaceful nations are becoming less peaceful.
And if it's not... Sorry to interrupt you. I was just going to ask the question, if it's not too... how are you measuring peace?
Well, we measure peace through a definition called the absence of violence or fear of violence. We've got three different domains which we measure. The first is internal safety and security. The second is the levels of ongoing conflict. And the third is the levels of militarization. So those three composites come together to form the Global Peace Index, which has 23 different measures of peace.
And you also had a section on the most improved countries. They included El Salvador, the UAE, Greece, Myanmar, and Nicaragua. Who had most deteriorated?
Well, when we look at it, that was the Ukraine and Israel. They had the two of the biggest deteriorations. And obviously, that's back for reasons which we all can see.
Yeah.
Palestine also, and yeah, that dropped massively as well. So Israel's now down in the bottom, the 10. Palestine's not far off it, and Ukraine's also in the bottom 10.
And thinking about then continent-wise, living in Europe, we feel, with all of the elections going on around us, it's slightly unsettled. Things don't feel quite as peaceful as they did 10 years ago, let's say, but still Europe sits at number one in peace continentally.
Yes, that's true, but it didn't drop substantially this year. And so what we find is the majority of countries in the Europe fell. It was about two-thirds of the countries actually fell. A lot of it is the ramifications which flowing on from the Ukrainian war, particularly sort of relationships with neighbouring states and increases in the levels of the expenditure spent on the military as well.
Well, that was another point that you mentioned in your talk, the fact that there are ripple effects on the countries and the economies of bordering neighbouring regions. And of course, because we live in a global economy, as you know so well, the ripple effects can be felt globally.
Yes, this is right. And you can look at this from many different angles. So I guess the first is the refugee flows. So we're looking at the Ukraine, for example. If you look at the Ukrainians in the age of 20 to 24, about 65% of them are now living outside of the Ukraine. So the war causes them to flow out. Now, the question is, will they come back? Similarly, you can see that the effects this has had on the industry in many different ways. Obviously, Europe was going to be dependent on Russian gas to heat and to winter and supply its various manufacturing plants. You can also see that a lot of car parts were manufactured in the Ukraine, particularly for German cars. That's all being cut off. And we can see the spike, which happened in oil prices just after the start of the Ukrainian war, how that had a ripple effect through the global economy in terms of inflation. And we can also see, if we go down and we look at the conflict in Gaza at the moment, and we look at the Red Sea, we see the Houthi attacks on ships. That's now causing a massive delays in many of the goods which are getting shipped around the world. And so this is now meaning boats are ending up without the containers, which are full in different parts of the world. Now that they can't go through the Red Sea, they're moving down and coming into places like Singapore, where they're unloading cargo off onto smaller ships for other destinations. This is now creating bottlenecks through other ports in the world. And this all disrupts the supply chain, means there's shortages, but also increased costs as well, increasing inflation.
Well, just moving to the other part of your life, the entrepreneurial part, I'm sure you have a deep knowledge of this, the supply chains, the moving parts, the moving costs and the flow in the economical flow, I mean now. So with your economical hat on, how would you be advising companies who have to have bases in different parts of the world for cost reasons? What should they be thinking about to change as we move into a slightly less stable global economy?
I think there's a serious need to look at the companies and the types of things you're doing. So if you're setting up manufacturing plants, particularly ones which you want to be there for 20 years or so, I think what you need to do is start to look at the risk factors associated with those countries. And so some of them have more risk than others, and there are various different ways of perceiving the risk. So one is to look at what its ranking is, let's say on the Global Peace Index, which is used in many different international indices to rate risk. But the other way is to look at the underlying factors which create peace. And that gives you an idea of the resilience and sustainability of that economy over the long term. And so I think as we're moving into a more dangerous age, what we need to do is to be able to have a look at a wider range of risk factors to better be able to assess what are the best destinations for investment. And it's simply no longer driven about the bottom line on what it's going to cost per good. The risk factors are really huge.
Would you be advising any companies to seriously consider moving their entire operations out of certain countries?
Well, I think really you've got to look at the individual country, the type of investment which they've got, because the reality is once you've made a large investment, very, very hard to move it. So look, it's very, without looking at a particular country and company and a particular country, it's very, very hard to make a call on that. But what I would say, and I think this is really important. So if we're looking at the results from this year's Global Peace Index, in some ways, it's the most sobering report we've put out. So we've got more conflicts now, 56, raging globally than any time since the end of the Second World War. We've got more countries engaged in a conflict beyond their border than since the inception of the Global Peace Index in 2008. That's 92 countries. And now what we're seeing is more and more conflicts are not getting solved. So just to underline that, if we went back to the 1970s, 49% of all conflicts ended up with a victory. That's either for the government or the rebels. That had dropped to 9% in the 2010s. And then if we come back, we look at peace agreements, there were 23% of conflicts finished with a peace agreement in the 1970s. That had dropped to 4% in the 2010s. And so this is actually disturbing. And it underpins why we can see the number of conflicts increasing, which aren't getting resolved.
What's the difference in your definition between a conflict and a war or terrorism? So I'll throw that in as well.
Sure. Okay. So what we classify as a conflict is greater than 25 deaths and under 1,000 deaths. 1,000 deaths, then we classify as a war. And so terrorism is most of it actually occurs within the concepts of a conflict. In fact, 92%, I think, last year of all deaths occurred in a conflict setting. But terrorism is something more. It's where there's an attack on people who are not actually engaged in the conflict with the aim of sending a message to more people than just those which are involved. So, for example, if you set a bomb off in a marketplace, for example, that's a clear terrorist attack because you're killing innocent civilians who've got nothing to do with the war. But more than that, you're sending a message to the population that we're out there, we can terrorise you, don't go to a market. And that falls in the definition of terrorism.
And then, as you mentioned, I would love to know your, given that you've done this for a number of years, what you have learned about how conflicts and wars end. You've given us some statistics on that, but what are the trends and what is the best way, if there is such a thing? Is it a peace agreement? Is it a victory? How do they end?
Well, they end either with, well, we can see in the 2010s, we found 9% have ended with a victory, 4% with a peace agreement. Then the remaining 87% didn't get a resolution. Some of them go into what you can call a frozen conflict, where you haven't got much activity going, but it's just sitting there in the background. So it depends on what you're looking at in terms of what's the best way to solve a conflict. So sometimes it's definitely a peace agreement. Other times an outright victory from one side can give a longer lasting peace. But it's very, very hard to make a comment without actually looking at an individual conflict and where it's at. Obviously, if we look at Islamic State, probably wasn't a great idea if we'd done a peace agreement with Islamic State and gave them half of Syria and Iraq. So a victory there was probably essential.
When it comes to places, countries that have no resolution and they're living in this frozen conflict, how does that affect the economics?
Well, this affects the economics in many, many different ways. So supply routes. So personal experience, I did a lot of work in Laos at one point in time. And we used to head up to the border of Cambodia. And that at stage as when you still had the Khmer Rouge operating out there. And you get up to the border and it was this dirt track which no one went down. No one went down. That's a thriving highway today. And so one of the issues is, like, when you've got a conflict, you can't transfer goods through it. You also find that farmers, for example, gets unsafe to plant their crops, but can get seized by the rebels or can get seized by government militias. And also it's just dangerous doing it. Similarly, in most conflicts, you get mines. Those mines now go down into agricultural areas, so you need to demine before you can even start again. Manufacturing, we can look at that too. Now, that gets restricted. The resources of the country now get moved towards a war economy, and the war economy doesn't actually produce goods. It produces bullets and ammunition and guns. And so you find that the manufacturing sector also gets crippled or strangled.
So that's the clear impact in many forms of war on the people and the land, literally on the land as well. Of course, many of us know that defence is an enormous industry. It's a thriving industry. And some businesses love a war. I really hate to say that, but it is the truth, let's call it the war economy, if you wish. But you have done research to really dig into the economic impact of peace versus the impact of defence. So tell us a bit more about that work.
Sure. Well, look, it's not that the defence industry in itself is bad, because obviously we don't live in a peaceful world. So therefore, we do need a level of defence which is capable of protecting us against the outside aggressors. Or we've got the alliances which can create for peace. But if you go and spend, let's say, an extra $10 billion on a battleship, now, the best you can hope for is not to use it. If you use it, then you probably did need it. But if you don't use it, then you've got the 10,000. You've got 1,000 to 2,000 or 3,000 people who are working on the ship. You've now got the cost of running it, another couple of $100 million a year. So that money could have been diverted to things like business stimulus, education, health, and then that would be a much more productive outcome for the economy. So it's not to say that there's anything wrong with much spending on defence, because we do need it. The question is, what is the right balance?
And how would you get governments to increase money to be spent on peace?
Well, I think the economic argument's the big one. So if we look at the cost of violence, and this is violence, not war, but the cost or conflict, it's much broader, but the cost of violence to the global economy in 2023, that was $19.1 trillion. That's the equivalent, 13.5% of global GDP. And that's a hefty whack. And that's probably light, because we can only count what we can count. So just to put that into bigger perspective, So if we could reduce that by 10%, which is, I think, within everyone's imagination is something possible, that'd be 1.9 trillion. That'd be like adding three new economies to the world, the size of Ireland, Switzerland, and Denmark. Or you can look at it another way. 1% of that, or 190 billion, is roughly what was spent on overseas developmental aid last year. But I think the striking statistic is 0.1% of that is what we spent on peacekeeping and peace building last year. So the message I'd have is, how can we put more money into preventive measures, particularly in the areas where you've got conflicts which are easy to solve, or conflicts which haven't erupted yet, but where it looks like the conditions are fragile. So if we could spend more money in those areas, I think that would be excellent.
Well, you mentioned places that are fragile, and in the talk, you also mentioned countries that are most at risk from conflict expansion, and they include Egypt, Israel, Iran, Jordan, and Lebanon. So this, again, is the ripple effects into those economies, increasing the risk of global recession, as you've laid out so clearly, and the risk of refugees, and ultimately terrorism as well. So there's so many ripple effects and issues that just flow from any conflict or war. What is your experience and your observations, your metrics on the flow of refugees?
What we can see is the flow of refugees from conflicts increasing. I think when we really started doing the index about the 2008, there's roughly 70 million to 75 million refugees. That's up to 120 million now. The problem with conflict is once they move, they tend not to go back, because conflicts last for time. They move into other areas. They then start to settle down. So it's very difficult for them to actually get back to where they come from. And that's different than natural disasters. The majority of people, the vast majority really of people in natural disasters, move back to where they come from some months after the disaster.
Are there any trends or patterns in how violence changes country to country or continent to continent?
Oh yes, it's very, very different. So if you're looking at the Middle East, Syria, Yemen, places like that, they're locked in war, and so that's really is war. If you're moving down to Latin America, like Mexico, Haiti would be good examples. They're controlled by cartels or gangs. And so the type of conflict does vary depending on the country in which it's in, and quite often the region. So if you went up to sub-Saharan Africa, went up to the Sahel, for example, it's mainly Islamist terrorists which are operating up there.
And have you seen, given that you've done this for a number of years and you're incredibly dedicated to it, have you seen any positive trends in peace?
Yeah, well, this is it. Like, if you're looking at homicides, they've been improving year on year. So we're looking back over the last year, we had 112 countries improve on the homicide. And similarly, people's perceptions of crime are improving all the time too. 96 countries, improved last year.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think in many ways we're just getting better. Police forces are getting more professional and better organised. I think the techniques for being able to detect crime and being able to solve crimes is improving all the time. So I think that has a lot to do with it.
And given that you are from a tech world and we have increasing technology at our fingertips, do you think people feel more global in nature? Do you feel they are becoming citizens of the world, or do you think there's a trend to become more nationalistic and patriotic? I ask this because I wonder if people feel more citizens of the world, they feel more of a shared humanity.
Well, I think it varies. It's varying from country to country. I think Europeans are feeling more like citizens of the world and getting more focused internally. I think that's because of dropping living standards in many ways. Other parts of the world where they've got expanding businesses which are moving internationally, and they're now middle classes. Wealth is rising and now they're doing a lot more travel. They're probably becoming more internationalized.
And then something you said at the talk as well, which really stuck with me. You said how you fight the war shapes how it goes after that. Explain that out for us, please.
Yeah, well, sort of in many ways, the way you fight the war does shape it afterwards. So, and really, a lot of it has to do with your reconstruction program. So if we go back and we, let's say, look at Iraq, we look at Afghanistan, won the wars, lost the peace. And a lot of it came back to not enough, a lot of money, massive money was put into reconstruction, but it wasn't done correctly. A lot of it was just assuming we'll pick some people who will back. Quite often they're very, very corrupt. And that then creates a backlash against those governments, and particularly with a lot of weapons floating around, that can get terribly negative. So that'd be one example. Similarly, if you've got a really repressive mechanism for being able to solve the conflict, what happens then? If you've now, once those people get a chance to look up, and they can, they'll fight back. And you can see that occurring in a number of different conflicts too. And finally, what I'd say is if you come in and there's ways of being able to solve conflicts, which it does involve military, but also involves a softer, more humanitarian approach. So what are the disagreements and the grievances which the people are fighting want? And what can you do to be able to satisfy them? So if you move that way, along with the military response, quite often you can now get into a sustained peace, which can work.
And something else that was brought up in the talk, which I have noted here, is the nature of having allies, determining where your natural allies are. And you actually pointed out China with the question of, does it have a natural ally, and actually does it need one?
Yeah, well, different countries have got different allies. So in the case of China, it's got countries that it's got great relationships and works well with. But when you're looking at natural allies, if you're looking more into the advanced Western democracies, they're very, very similar in terms of their philosophical ideas and approaches. And so there's a lot more likely to get synergy between those countries, and there is quite often with the authoritarian regimes.
You're a member of the Club of Madrid, as I understand it. What is the Club of Madrid?
Oh, it used to be on the, not anymore, but I used to be on the President's Council of the Club of Madrid. And so that's the organisation of ex-prime ministers and presidents of democratic countries. I think they've got about 120 members currently.
Mm-hmm. And from that, I mean, I looked at what it meant and who was part of it. You must have had some incredible conversations.
Yeah, no, I've had many, many interesting ones over the years.
I can see there won't be any expansion there. Given the work that you've done over a lifetime of philanthropic work, what are the highlights, the things that really make you want to do this work further? Because I can imagine, given what you sit and read every day, it could be quite depressing. But what gives you hope?
I think what gives me hope, particularly out of the Family Foundation, is just the watching people's lives in many ways transform. So you get more water into someone in a very poor, remote, rural area. You sort of can give them two, sometimes three times more food. And so that comes through the water and getting more crops. And then, like, that massively, massively increases their wealth. So if you think about it, it's like giving you a 300% pay rise.
And in fact, it just comes down to living standards and eating and drinking.
Well, that's part of it. Other ones that really moved me as well, like rehabilitation of child soldiers. Did that up in northern Uganda for many years, and from that, I just drove home the suffering, the just huge level of suffering that people have in conflict. When we live in the West, we see the images of the places getting blown up, and we see some people crying and people injured, but we don't, unless you actually see it, just really understand how horrific the impact actually is. And so those kind of things have shaped me in many, many ways before. And then sort of other times, it's like I can remember in Laos, we started there when it was still a closed country. And so we put in a whole lot of water projects there for about 40,000 people. We dropped the birth rate for kids the death rate for kids under five from 18% down to 12%. And got rid of the 30% of the disease because it was waterborne. And so those kind of things, they really stick with me. And they're for less than $20 a head. So the number of lives you save, small amounts of money sometimes is staggering.
How do you physically go about doing this, to move into a country like Laos, for example? Talk us through the logistics of this. Who are you talking to allow you to do this work on the ground? And how do you manage it without being able to communicate in the language of the local people there in the villages?
Well, it's pretty simple, really. So what we do is we partner up with other organisations which have the on-the-ground footprints in these countries and we're allowed in. And then, obviously, there's a lot of people who were fluent in English and fluent in the local languages, and you always have a trusted translator with you.
And then from these experiences, which is the country that most interests you?
I don't know if I have one country which most interests me. Iceland's a fascinating country. I'd recommend anyone to go for a holiday there. I guess I've spent a lot of time in Kenya and Uganda, and like those countries I really enjoy going to. I find them really interesting, and sort of there's a lot of talent in Africa, but there's also a lot of governments which are just very, very weak on governance. The real issue for Africa is improving its governance.
And how can that help? How can that happen?
Well, look, that's a dependent. You've got to look at the individual country and then make decisions around the state of that individual country rather than just coming up with a couple of blanket ideas. But sort of just corruption, like corruption's endemic in many African countries. Trying to be able to reduce corruption would be very, very good, I think, and I think that'd be a great start.
And then just bringing it back to you, Steve, I mean, there are not many people who have the level. Well, first of all, there's not many people who have the level of success that you have achieved. So congratulations on that. But then to move that success into such incredible philanthropic work, what is it from your background that has motivated you to move in this way?
Well, look, I don't actually, Lisa, I don't actually understand what motivates me. I get this question a lot. It's a really common question. But I think it's something intuitive within us moves us in different ways. I just, like, once you've got after a certain amount of money, how much more money do you need? What do you need to do with it? So and I guess from that angle, that pushed me into thinking, well, we'll do something philanthropic. And then I guess from that, thought, where's the most need? And I thought, well, that's with the poorest of the poor. And that's basically a motivation. And then I've already been through how the Institute for Economics and Peace started. That was through a simple question. And guess that's what motivates me.
Yeah, but not everybody with your level. I guess it's a common question, because not everybody with your level of success and the wealth that has come with that thinks about philanthropy. They think about other businesses. I mean, I can think of a number of businessmen.
I think there's a lot of businessmen who give a lot of money. A lot of them give them a lot more anonymously than me. Okay, but there's some standouts there. Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, for example, they're given. Between it maybe $100 billion, I don't know, huge amounts of money. And then in Australia, in the environment I'm in, I'm more upfront with what I'm doing. That's mainly because I'm trying to proselytise peace, but a lot of them don't really come to the forefront. They just stay in the background and give.
And what would you like your legacy to be with this work that you're doing with the Institute of Economics and Peace and the Global Peace Index?
I think if we're looking at our legacy, or my legacy anyway, it's not about me. It's a bit like it's like ripple effects. We do things in our lives which have ripples. And those ripples just carry on. And so if you're in a pond, you throw a ripple in, it'll get to the other end, a bigger ripple. that might even get through a nation. But it's all about sort of the flow and effects from what you can do. And so your legacy is really the result of the actions of what you do. Thinking too much about your personal legacy, I don't think is even smart.
Thank you, Steve, so much. Is there anything else you would like to share with our audience?
No, I'm happy, Lisa.
Well, I wish you a wonderful holiday with your family, and thank you for everything that you do for the world. We are so grateful for you putting metrics on what peace means and the value of peace economically in our society and our global world.
Thanks, Lisa. Love being on the show. Thank you for the questions.
The Lisa Burke Show.
RTL Original Podcast.